You are in fellowship. We are dealing here with what is commonly referred to as the triumphal entry, but the whole point of doing it on a donkey was not so much as a triumph. One would expect a returning conqueror to come in on a horse, a steed of some sort. A donkey would be somewhat more humble. So we're dealing with this issue of the obedient servants here, the apostles in this case. They went away and found a colt, verse 4, tied at the door outside in the street, and they untied it. And some of the bystanders were saying to them, again, Luke is more explicit. He says some even among the bystanders were the actual owners of the colt. So they quizzed him as well. What are you doing untying the colt? And they spoke to them just as Jesus had told them, exactly as, and they gave them permission. And we're ready to resume here with point 12. The apostles find the mother and foal tied outside, which would be somewhat unusual. Normally, animals were not left in the street where they would be subject to theft. And 13, people also tended to keep their animals in the yard or courtyard because the streets were generally pretty narrow and did not allow for easy passage of traffic. This may have been a little bit more of a broad thoroughfare because of the nature of where it was leading, the cities it tied together, from Bethany over the Mount of Olives down through Bethphage into Jerusalem. This one may have been a little bit bigger. But 14, the term used for street is the Greek amphodon, which refers to a thoroughfare that surrounded a city or city square. And the more broad nature of this road may help explain why there was room for the animals to be tethered outside. So 15, as they are untying the colt and its mother as well, they are accosted by some that are observing these events unfold. 16, although Matthew mentions nothing of any opposition to their activity, Mark mentions that some were standing around that area and objected to their actions. Luke alone records the fact that the owners of the animal were also present and voiced their question as well. And that was Luke 19:33, where essentially it just says, the owners said to them that they were part of this group standing around. And 17, this provides another lesson for believers as they attempt to execute the will of God for their lives. There are going to be those that do not understand what you are doing and may seek to hinder your obedience. And 18, while opposition may come from those that are hostile or simply well-meaning, you've got the gamut of ways people can oppose you and reasons why they do. Some people may oppose you and they're well-meaning. They think they're doing you a favor. Other people, they just oppose you because they're hostile and desire to make it as difficult on you as they can. The opposition in this case did not consist of anything more than simply questioning the apostles with respect to their intentions. So, the opposition can run the gamut of little minor things up to, major persecution and death. Well, 19, however, the believer should be aware of the fact that he may face far more significant opposition in the angelic conflict. This may range from mental attitude hostility for no apparent reason, as referenced in John 15, 18 and 19. And this just deals with the general attitude of the cosmos. The world itself is nothing more than a reflection of Satan's perverted genius. It is a world that is based first and foremost on the principle of pride and arrogance. That's because that's what Satan's all about. It is based on lies. It is based on darkness. And what appears on the surface, possibly in the cosmos out there to be benign, has a more sinister underlying truth to it. And that is, this world hates God. And they hate those that are associated with God, and so as Luke and other people do, James, why would the believer ever want to seek these people out for fellowship or anything? They hate your father. What kind of child hangs out with those people that hate their father? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Well, John 15:18, and this is the underlying current, if the world hates you, and it does, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you are of the world, and again, this is the problem with believers seeking to fit in with their cosmic counterparts. You're not supposed to. You're not of this world. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. And that's just the normal MO of the world. It's not going to change. It's not going to get better. It may be shoved underground. It may be beneath the surface. It may not be manifested overtly all the time, either verbally or overtly. But it's still there. There's an underlying tension in the angelic conflict between those that are on the right side and those that are on the wrong side. And that's just never going to change, and nor should it. Well, it can go for a parent from a hostility for no apparent reason to verbal attacks of slander or maligning, 1 Peter 2:12. And that's largely what the book of 1 Peter is about, is obedience and the types of suffering that it can bring and how to deal with it. Primarily, Peter focuses on verbal slander and that at first, because this was the MO of the angelic conflict at this point. Primarily, Christians were being slandered. There were not, generally speaking, as far as we understand it, at the time of Peter, they had not exercised or passed laws to persecute Christians. But Christians were problematic because they weren't viewed as being good citizens of the Roman Empire, because they had this other Lord. His name was Jesus. And they didn't accept Caesar as their Lord. And so they were viewed sometimes as being subversive, these other factors. And so there was a lot of talking going on about Christians and what they were and what they believed. And Peter, essentially, a lot of this book is telling believers, be obedient to God, because in this way, you're going to undermine their attacks. It's not that they still won't attack. You can't stop them. You cannot stop hostility and negative volition in the angelic conflict. If there are people that are committed to your downfall, they're probably going to remain committed to your downfall. Now, they may not ever succeed, and that just frustrates them. But what we can do about all this is, rather than respond in kind, and that's the problem, that's the easy thing to do, we are to keep our behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in that thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Submit yourselves, for the Lord's sake, to every human institution. And then he starts on this necessity of obedience to authority, beginning with the establishment chain of command, the kings and the governors, and everybody else that they may appoint in terms of the physical realities of a nation, the authority structure within a nation. Then he moves to the job market, or the job region. Servants, 18, be submissive to your masters, with all respect. Then he moves to the home life, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. To the wife, and then to the husband, you husbands, verse 7, in the same way, be submissive to your wives. Although the submission there is found in orientation to the weaker vessel principle. Living with her in an understanding way. That's the way the male submits to the female in the marriage relationship. And so, essentially, he says obedience to these authority structures will go a long way in silencing these idiots. Now, it doesn't mean you're fully going to silence them. If you have critics and they're determined to criticize you, well, you probably aren't going to be able to do anything about it. But the one thing you can do, as it says here, verse 16 of chapter 3, keep a good conscience, so that in that thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. For it's better, you know, if you're going to have to suffer, it's better to suffer for righteousness than for evil, for doing what is wrong. And then finally, you can get down to attacks, bodily assault, and even murder. Acts 14:5. So suffering and the attacks of the cosmos can run the gamut. Typically, in Western Christianity, we are not dealing with overt persecution at this point. But we also are pretty clear, I mean, if anybody's paying attention to current events, we've got a government that really believes that they can incarcerate anybody at any time for any reason. And they don't have to offer an explanation, and they don't have to give you due process or anything else. All they got to do is slap a terrorist label on you and you're done. And that's all they got to do. And the fact is, in the court of public opinion, once they do that, you're probably judged guilty by 90% of the people that hear about it. And, I mean, we talk about guilty, innocent until proven guilty. That's not true in our society anymore at all. These things are all being tried on TV, essentially, as a form of entertainment and distraction. So Acts 14:5 here, and when an attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to mistreat and stone them, they became aware of it and fled to the cities of Lycaonia, Lystra, and Derbe and the surrounding region. And they continued to preach the gospel. This didn't stop Paul in this situation. Acts 16:16-23, this one, I believe, is a situation that arises. And again, much of this, many times, Christianity has come under attack because it has struck at the fundamental problem that will always get the cosmos going, and that's their love of money. Money makes the world go round, and the cosmos likes money. And you start messing with somebody's pocketbook, and you're going to get a reaction probably pretty quick. And in this case, pardon me, here in Acts 16, it happened as we were going to the place of prayer, a slave girl having a spirit of divination met us and was bringing her masters much profit by fortune telling. And following after Paul, she kept crying out, and Paul finally cast the demons out of her. But what creates the problem? When her master saw that their hope of profit was gone. Oh, it's not that we're against Christianity per se, or even Paul. But now you've touched our money. And that is it. They seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the authorities. And of course they lie about it. They say they don't tell the judge, you know, what's the real issue here. They say these men are throwing our city into confusion because they're Jews. Jews do this, you know that. This is the way Jews are. They run around and create confusion. Well, that's kind of racist and anti-Semitic, but you know, let's not deal with that. And they're proclaiming customs which are not lawful for us to accept. We are Romans. And the emphasis in this, I remember doing this passage in Acts, and the emphasis is strongly on, they're Jews, and we're Romans. And I mean, the emphasis is very strongly on that. And the crowd rose up together against them, and the chief man, well, what about an actual charge here? Oh, no, let's not bother ourselves with due process, or charging this person with a crime, or allowing them to confront their accusers, or any other factor. Let's just judge them guilty and beat the crap out of them. And that's what they did. And when they had struck them with many blows, they threw them into prison, commanding the jailer to guard them securely. And having received the command, he threw them into the inner prison. They're in solitary now. And fastened their feet in the stocks. This doesn't, you know, that resulted in a pretty severe beating, but it leads to the salvation of the Philippian jailer. So Revelation 2:10, another lesson we can take away from all these various forms of suffering. Things you go through, testing in life, suffering you endure. Well, number one, there may be a real benefit at the end of all of that, in that there may be a spiritual benefit to someone who observes all of it. And the Philippian jailer, you know, saw this real close up. And then Revelation 2:10, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be tested. And you will have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful till death, and I will give you the crown of life. Well, 10 days may not sound like long, and there's obviously a prophetic element to this passage as well, but in the literal sense, one may think, well, going to prison and then waiting 10 days to die wouldn't be that bad. 10 days can be a long time. And if you know at the end of it, you're going to die, because if they went to prison, of course, this was not like our prison system. When they went to prison, they did not come out. They died, typically. I mean, it's not that anyone was never acquitted. They were. Paul got out of, say, the first Roman imprisonment. But it was only because the Jews failed to present their case, and the Romans had to drop the charges. But typically, if you were charged something, put in prison, you died. So again, this can run the gamut of everything. Just simple hatred that's not expressed, overt expressions of hatred verbally, name calling, and then physically just attempting to make your life miserable. 20, the apostles continue their course of obedience and respond to those that questioned them with the explanation that Jesus had told them to offer. And 21, as these men have functioned in obedience to exactly what they are told, it had to become evident to the two apostles that this all unfolded precisely as Jesus had told them it would. Well, one of the questions this would beg, where does he get all this knowledge of the future? How do you know this donkey had never been sat on? Blah, blah. I mean, all kinds of questions arise out of this. But the apostles are dull and they don't apparently ask them or follow it through or come to any real conclusions. They just observe it. Well, 22 verse 6 concludes with the fact that the owners and whoever else was present did not ultimately refuse these men. Rather, they acknowledged their right to take the animals and gave them permission to proceed. So far, you know, this is all going, again, according to plan. Verse 7, they brought the colt to Jesus and put their coats on it, and he sat on it. And again, as a chi here that's not translated, Pharaoh, they bring or bear. This normally means to carry or bear, but actually it more often in Mark it appears to mean nothing more than they led them. They led the colt to Jesus. I mean, you've got another verb for leading like ago, but Pharaoh seems to be the way Mark likes to present it. A present active indicative, again, an historic present designed to be more vivid. They are bringing the colt to Jesus. The forward colt is polos again. To Jesus, preposition pros, to or toward, and the Jesus. And put their coats upon it. And as chi, again, all present indicatives here. Epibalo is the verb, E-P-I-B-A-L-L-O, which means to throw or cast, and epi means upon, which is the perfect verb for this. So they threw their coats, and this would be their outer garments, on it to form sort of a makeshift saddle. On it, altos, the donkey. And they threw on it their garments. And again, this is the definite article to with hemation. Hemation, the outer garments, their robes or cloaks of them. Presumably, this is the apostles doing this, but we don't know how many people did it. I mean, obviously, they can only throw, you only needed a couple on it. You didn't need like hundreds. That wouldn't have been convenient. So the they are an unidentified, and it could very well be limited to the two that brought it back. They're the in context. They are the nearest antecedent. They went away in verse 4. They spoke to them, verse 6. They're the nearest antecedent. So it would appear that the two apostles did this. They cast on their outer garments of them, and he sat down. Aorist indicative of kathizo, to sit down upon it, preposition upon it, the donkey. Epi plus the accusative of autos. And many spread their coats in the road, and others spread leafy branches which they had cut from the fields. And as chi here translated this time, and many, polis the adjective, great, much, or many, depending upon context, many of the people present, and many, their garments, accusative here, the garments is forward for emphasis, the fact that they're throwing their coats down. Well, a couple of reasons for this. Number one, pretty clearly, it's a demonstration of honor of some sort. It's a demonstration of respect. But also, physically, from the time of year, depending upon when this all happened, and this all happened later in the day, the reason they all had their garments off was because it was probably warm by then. This is a spring day. And I don't know that we can go back and find the temperature, nor does that help you grow spiritually. But the point is, what started out probably as a coolish morning in the spring, now is later in the day, maybe as late as 3 or 4 or 5. We're not told exactly. But what does become apparent is that this all takes place. Jesus allows enough time for everybody to figure out, or for many people, to find out he's in Bethany, and then he waits till late in the day the next day to begin this approach to Jerusalem, allowing even more time for word to spread. So their garments, the garments of them, hemation again with the definite article, of them, genitive, garments of the many, they spread is stronuo, S-T-R-O-N-N-U-O. Six times this word means to distribute something over a surface, to spread something out. And they spread them out. They weren't just throwing them down, as it were. They were opening them up and spreading them out upon the road, upon the way, road, or path, a preposition ice here. Normally, you might expect a pea or something. Into the road, literally, is the idea of it. But again, clearly, it's just covering the surface. They're throwing them in the road. But others spread leafy branches, which they had cut from the fields. But others, as Alas, here others of the same kind, i.e., those with Jesus going to the feast. I believe these are all just pilgrims that are traveling on that same road. And now Jesus is somehow singled out here. And one of the reasons was a custom that even if you were riding an animal into Jerusalem, that you would get off of it before you went into the city. And Jesus didn't do that. Jesus remained upon the animal. So other pilgrims, spread leafy branches. Again, you got the accusative here forward. Stibas. S-T-I-B-A-S. This is only used once, another hopox. A bed of straw, leaves, or reeds. Here we find out they were leafy branches. Leafy branches that they had cut down, literally after cutting them off or down. Kopto is the verb, and it means exactly that, to cut something off of something else, to cut it down. Having cut them down from the fields. From is preposition ek, and then the word agros, the noun from the fields. We get our word agriculture, obviously that's the root for that. And it refers to open country, you know, typically farms and that sort of things, fields out there. This is obviously before they're getting into the city proper. There's plenty of open country out there still. Well, point one, the narrative continues with the ongoing obedience of the two servant apostles who have been sent to retrieve the donkey for Jesus. Two, while Mark records only the presence of a single donkey, it is evident from Matthew's account that they actually brought back both the female donkey and her foal. Matthew makes that explicit, that they found two of them there, that they not only found them, of course, that they brought them both. This makes good sense for a couple of reasons. Number one, obviously it kept the foal calmer. One guy pointed out that Jesus must have been a heck of a cowboy. Because you don't typically get on unbroken, unridden animals and have it go quite this well. But if the donkey is there, and obviously the foal, the colt, he's big enough to carry a full-grown man, so it's not like he's a newborn or anything. But the colt had been used to being with its mother. The mother clearly had borne burdens and was a beast of burden. And so the colt had some experience with this. But given the festive nature of the crowd, I mean, so many things could have gone wrong here, and maybe should have gone wrong. I mean, if that colt bucks and throws Jesus off head first, you know, I was watching the other day. I don't know if any of you follow it, but if you follow that show, Deadliest Catch, they had a deal on After the Catch, and these captains, tough guys, went to vacation in Colorado. And one of them decided he was going to, well, several of them I think did, but one of them decided he was going to ride this little bull. It was a small one too. I mean, the captain was nearly bigger than the cow he was on. And this thing takes off, and I mean, he must have been on it for 0.8 seconds. And you know, to be a bull rider, you got to stay on for 8 seconds. He must have been on 0.8 seconds. And you see him go off sideways. And he gets up, oh, I'm all right. We find out he had 3 broken ribs. So how many things could have gone wrong here? Well, clearly there's a divine element in all of this over which God is watching and of which Jesus is aware. But for him to get on an unridden animal, that's out of the ordinary. And then for it to go smoothly would be even more out of the ordinary. But how many of these people actually knew this donkey was unridden? Well, probably just Jesus and the two, because he told them. But the owners would have. But who knows if the owners were even there? Maybe they followed him back. We're not really ever told what they did. Just that they gave him permission. So Matthew 21:7, they brought the donkey and the colt, and they laid their coats on them. Why they laid them on the donkey? We're not told. I don't know that anybody rode her. It's not stated that they did. Well, three, since there's no indication of a change of subjects, it makes sense to understand that the two apostles were the ones that placed their outer garments on the young donkey. Since the donkey had not been ridden previously, it would not have had saddle cloths with it. Four, normally a cloth of wool was folded several times and used as a saddle. This provided some comfort for the rider. I mean, if you've ever been on an animal, you probably know the difference between riding them bareback and having some sort of a saddle. Well, this provided comfort for the rider and kept the animal from chafing as well. And five, while we are not told exactly what the thinking of the apostles was at this point, it seems that they recognized that something of significance was occurring. Now, what? They probably didn't have any idea. But the action of placing their garments on the donkey certainly suggests their willing participation in Jesus' plans, whatever those plans are. And I don't know that Jesus has told anybody what he's doing other than we're going to Jerusalem. But they would have already figured that out. But why this entry this way? Well, obviously you and I know. They didn't. Although these verses should have come to their mind. They should have been familiar with this. Well, six, there can be little doubt that they were expecting the immediate inauguration of the kingdom. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt of that in their thinking. I think they've manifested this repeatedly. The kingdom is here. We're just waiting. Come on, come on, come on. And, you know, they're probably a little frustrated with Jesus that he's not getting on with it. Well, maybe they look at this and say, hey, here we go. This is the first step. Jesus is riding in to let them know. Well, thus, their actions are similar, not identical, to what others did at the accession of Jehu. 2 Kings 9, 12 and 13. So when a king was, as it were, coming to office or coming to town, people responded in certain ways. And again, they're not identical here, but there's enough similarity. 2 Kings 9, 12 and 13. And they said, it is a lie, tell us now. And he said, thus and thus he said to me, thus says the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel. And they hurried, and each man took his garment and placed it under him on the bare steps, and blew the trumpet, saying, Jehu is king. So there is some precedent for this casting of garments, both on the donkey and even in the road, in front of Jesus. And in many people's thinking, or some people's thinking at least, it may have very well reflected the fact that they thought he was royalty and he was getting ready to ascend the throne. And so when understood in that context, what they're doing here makes sense. Now, are there many people in that crowd that day that have no clue what's happening? Most of them have no clue what's happening. In fact, I don't know that anybody in that crowd exactly knew what was happening. And this is another good point here, that you can get all these people that are psyched about stuff. And you can get them all jazzed up. And you can really get them going. But you know what? They may not have a clue as to what you're doing. And the same thing is true here. These people don't have a clue about what Jesus is doing. And the ones that think they know are probably misguided. And that would be the apostles. They probably suspect that this is the accession. Here we go. All right, he's getting on with it, finally. Well, the others, they just get caught up in the moment. How many people do that, though? They get in a crowd, and they get caught up with the moment, and they're swept along in it, and it's all euphoria for the moment or whatever. And then when it's over, you know, what happened? I don't know. I was just there. I had a good time, though. Okay. But what did it mean? And most in this crowd have no clue what any of this means. It's completely lost on them. Well, seven, although not directly stated by Mark, it seems likely that someone led the mother and Jesus rode along behind her seated on the foal. Eight, it was customary, I misspelled there, but led the mother should be led. It was customary when entering Jerusalem during the pilgrim feasts to express great joy. Okay. This part of it is not unusual. The crowds were normally boisterous. They were excited. And many of these feasts, of course, there's this messianic expectation in the air. And many of these feasts were times of revelry and happiness. And so that all is not unusual. That, in fact, would kind of go with the feast, whole process of the feast here. However, even when one was riding a mule or horse, he would normally dismount and enter through the gates on foot, which was, to the Jews, an expression of humility. You were humbling yourself. Well, 9, although nothing has been mentioned about anyone other than Jesus and his disciples, it is evident that a significant crowd had accompanied them on the road to Jerusalem. That's not hard to figure out. But we had this set up for us sort of in the previous chapter. In verse 46, there was a large crowd leaving Jericho. Well, as we're approaching the Passover week, the crowds obviously are getting bigger and bigger coming into Jerusalem as the day gets closer. They don't actually have to be there until the day of the Passover. And it would probably make sense for them to be there. And plus, lodging was a problem during this time. So some people would come in earlier to assure themselves of a place to stay. Others would wait until the last minute. But as you drew closer to it, of course, the numbers were going up. And so these roads were more and more crowded with people. 10, only John records the fact that when Jesus was at the house of Simon for a dinner with Lazarus, that was like Sunday afternoon, evening, that large numbers of people made the trip to Bethany to see Jesus and the man he had so recently raised from the dead. John's account here, where it comes together with the synoptic accounts, still contains a great deal of independent, unique information that you would not get from reading the other accounts. The large crowd of Jews. Well, actually, we're told that there was a dinner. So they made him a supper in verse 2, and Martha was serving. And again, I point out that Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him, that this was not in their house. This was in the house of Simon the leper. But you find that from the synoptic parallels and put it together with John. Now, the large crowd of the Jews then learned he was there. And they came, not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So this is the one, you know, poor Lazarus, get him. He dies. That's, rough enough on you, I presume. He gets raised from the dead. Well, that's good. Now there's a murder plot against him. I mean, this guy's got it tough. And there's no indication that this ever succeeded. So, again, that's John 12:9. 11, nothing is mentioned of the events of Sunday other than the dinner party for Lazarus. And it would seem that many came out during the course of that day. Oh, I say it was for Lazarus. I mean, I think Jesus and Lazarus were the two sort of guests of honor at that party. That Lazarus now has his own celebrity by virtue of being raised from the dead. Well, what was it like? People would want to see him. Wouldn't you like to interview somebody who had been dead for 3 days? Well, what was it like? I mean, this is a guy you could legitimately interview and maybe get some good information from. Well, people would like to, I mean, that to me would be an object of fascination for any normal person. If you had the opportunity to see this guy and you could sit down with him at dinner and talk to him and ask him, well, what was death like? What happens after? And I mean, he has the answers, literally. Well, you sure don't want him running around telling people, well, Jesus is the Son of God, and actually if you go to heaven if you believe in him, but, you really, if you're the leadership of the Jews, you don't want that. So again, so it would seem that many came out during the course of that day and then returned to Jerusalem by evening. Typically, the Jews like to have their traveling and all done around sundown. They weren't to travel after dark, nor was there any real reason to. Obviously, it's more dangerous. That's still true. Things happen at, if you're out at 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning and something goes wrong, the odds are greatly better that it will go wrong at 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning than it will at 2 in the afternoon. Because who else is out at 2 or 3 in the 4 in the morning? Well, the drunks, the drug addicts, the prostitutes. What could go wrong there? And then, then you got the poor paper people that have to get up at 4 or whatever to go throw papers. Well, obviously, at certain time, after sundown, it becomes more dangerous. Thieves can't be seen as readily. Ambushes are easier. So the Jews, like most normal people, wanted to get things done by dark. Well, 12, John makes it clear in his gospel that the entry to Jerusalem did not occur until the following day, which accounts for why so many would be aware of Jesus' proximity to Jerusalem, and perhaps even to the timing of his entry. Now, I didn't give you the verse there, but that's John 12:12. And then this is in between this is sandwiched the idea that the chief priests wanted to kill Lazarus because many were believing in Jesus. And on the next day, the large crowd who had come to the feast, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. Now, these are probably, and in fact, are not native Jerusalemites. The people in Jerusalem were not nearly as amenable to Jesus as one might think. And so, recognize that in these crowds coming in, the ones coming from Galilee and all were far more familiar with Jesus and far more exposed to his ministry and seemed to be far more amenable to him. But the group in Jerusalem, given the hostility of the religious establishment, given the rules that had come down from the top, that if you associate with Jesus, if you acknowledge him as the Messiah, if we find you in any way associating with this reprobate, you're excommunicated from Israel. You'll be cast out. And that'll mean loss of job, loss of prestige, loss of family, loss of friends, can't come to the temple, etc., etc. Your life is completely wrecked if you associate with Jesus. And so obviously one of the things, it was far more a meaningful thing in that time to suggest that you were loyal to Jesus, especially if you were a Jew, because it could cost you everything. And so many people, we see that exactly, say there in John 9, when the guy gets healed, the guy born blind, and his parents won't really talk to the Jews because they're scared. And most people were scared of the religious leadership. They had their bluff in on all of them. And as we know, as we have seen with Herod, political leaders, and I think no doubt they knew this about some of the religious leaders, these guys were cold-blooded. And they did not mind resorting to violence and other things to get their ends accomplished. And so they do not want to mess with these guys. And so the people in Jerusalem aren't nearly as amenable to Jesus as the people outside. To them, Jesus is problematic. So don't assume when you kind of read all this as they're going into Jerusalem that the people who, the native people, the native inhabitants of Jerusalem, that they embraced Jesus with open arms. They did not. And they, in many ways, reflected what the views of the Sanhedrin and the religious leaders were out of fear. But that's that deal. So again, we get John 12:12 that he waits till the next day to go. And that's what tips us off, the chronology of John's helpful, in that it tips us off that it wasn't until Monday that he went. Having spent the Sabbath night down there with in Jericho with Zacchaeus, and then the next day making the trip to Lazarus' house, or even to the Simon the leper, we're not told specifically which one they stayed at, but this will become important as we go through this week. So 13, although the reader is not told the exact order of events in any of the gospel accounts, it would make some sense to believe that Jesus let everyone know he intended to go to Jerusalem at some point on Monday. I don't think this was a secret. A lot of times Jesus would do things, of course, and he didn't let people know he was going to do it or why. He maintained a certain amount of secrecy. In this case, I think he knows that prophetically, secrecy is not called for anymore. And in fact, as he goes into Jerusalem on this donkey, he is presenting himself to Israel as their king. The prophecy in Zechariah makes that plain. Your king comes to you. Humble. And this was a real problem for the Jews, and especially for the interpreters, the scribes and all, because they couldn't reconcile the glory of Messiah with this donkey thing. And so they were very confused about that, so they came up with a way to explain it, which we will deal with. So 14, the longer in the day he waited to begin the actual travel would allow more time for the word to spread about his intentions. Additionally, as the day advanced, more pilgrims would be on the road. And that makes sense because these people, again, the ones that are traveling the same route Jesus did, are all coming up from Jericho. And there were large crowds there already, and there's nothing in my thinking to presume that that did not continue to be the case as Passover is drawing near. Well, 15, this accounts for the two crowds that converge at some point on the road into Jerusalem. There was a significant crowd of pilgrims on the road anyway, which Jesus joined at some point on Monday with his entourage. Now, we're not told how many of them all went with Jesus. Presumably the 12 did. But they always seem to have accompanied him. But did Lazarus and them join him that day? We're not really told. Or even Simon the leper, we're not told. But we know Jesus has this entourage that's with him, however big it may be. At the minimum, it was 12 other guys. But there may have been other disciples following him. And we're presuming that Bartimaeus is still with him, that he followed him from that point on, it appears. So 16, as word spread in Jerusalem about the fact that Jesus was on the road into the city, many went out to meet him in a spontaneous display of apparent, I should have double underlined that and bolded it, apparent acceptance and respect. Because what appears here on the surface to be this great welcome for a, quote, conquering king, will within 4 days be transformed into cries for his head. So these people are flaky. At best, many of them are flaky at best. And 17, however, has often been the case, the crowd was composed of a mixture of people. Although some in the crowd may have lived in Jerusalem, the majority were likely pilgrims from other areas, including Galilee, in town for the feast. 18, there was a significant population in Jerusalem normally. Best estimates are about 80,000. But this swelled to over 2 million during the feast time. At least that's the best suggestions we have. Which I mean, you're talking about a huge influx of people during these times. And one of the things that becomes clear is that the city couldn't handle all this. You know, it's like, unfortunately, tourist season here, for lack of a better thing. You know, like you can go to the restaurant now at 6 o'clock and get a table, walk in, sit down. But, you know, in February, you go at 6 o'clock and you may be waiting an hour and a half. Because the infrastructure just really can't handle it. And so many of these people stayed in the outlying region. Some would sleep in the open country. Some would stay in Bethany, which was a couple of miles away at one of the outlying suburbs. Some in Bethpage. Some even just stayed on the Mount of Olives and camped out. So there are a ton of people, anyway, at this point in the deal. Well, 19, in addition to those wanting to see Jesus, ostensibly for commendable reasons, there were also hostile forces present in the crowd. Luke tells us about that, Luke 19:39. So lest you get the idea that, oh, Jesus is coming into the city and, oh, this is a hero's welcome and everybody's for him. No. That was part of it, but that was only part of it. Luke 19:39, these people are shouting, blessed is the king, in 38, who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, teacher, rebuke your disciples. In other words, we don't want to hear this kind of talk. This is out of line. They should not be saying this. And Jesus said, I tell you, if these will become silent, the stones will cry out. So you best just let them go on. It would be more of a miracle if the rocks started singing. So no, I'm not going to rebuke them. 20, although some have proposed a utilitarian, a reason for the actions of the crowd that day as they cast their clothing and vegetation on the road, i.e. the thin layer of clothing and vegetation would help the young donkey on the slopes. It seems better to view the actions of the crowd as spontaneous, unnecessary, and the somewhat lavish way of receiving one perceived to be a dignitary. I think that's far more acceptable. I mean, they threw him on the ground because they were afraid the donkey would slip. No, I don't think so. Donkeys are actually usually pretty sure-footed, and they're used to bearing burdens and all that, so no, I don't buy that. People get really creative with this stuff when there's actually no reason to. I mean, the natural reading of the text just seems to me to shout a spontaneous display. And people do this kind of thing. It happens. And that's what I think is happening here. Well, 21, this type of activity was the regular kind of treatment offered to important persons and was considered as an expression of appreciation and respect. 22, there are parallels in Jewish and secular literature for a spontaneous display of respect. Plutarch relates the fact that when Cato Minor left his troops, they spread their clothes at his feet. This is when he was retiring. While Maccabees records the fact that Simon Maccabeus entered in Jerusalem, he was received with thanksgiving, the branches of palm trees, with harps and cymbals, and with viols and hymns and songs, because there was destroyed a great enemy out of Israel. That's 1 Maccabees 15:31, and it deals with the destruction of the forces of the Seleucids, particularly Antiochus Epiphanes, as he was ejected from Israel. So this is not unusual in history, in other words. So what we have here, I mean, again, while it's unique in the Bible in that sense because it's the Lord, the fact was this was not unprecedented. Well, 23, Mark records the fact that many spread their garments, while Matthew mentions that it was most of the multitude. Luke gives the least specific definition, as he notes they were spreading their coats. And John does not mention any garments at all. You can see those verses that basically I put them in there for you, the important points here in the bold. That Luke is more general, Mark says many, and Matthew says most. So this, again, as this happens, as is not unusual, when this type of spontaneous thing occurs, people get swept up in the moment. Now, do they know who Jesus is? Do they have any real respect for him or understand anything about him? Not necessarily. But this crowd is psyched, and it is a feast time, and oh my God, we're at Mardi Gras. Woo! Now, people don't do anything crazy there, right? They don't get caught up in the moment and go wild or anything. Well, it's that same type of thing, but not obviously with the debauchery sort of deal, but... But I mean, as they're going into Jerusalem, it's the same kind of thing. People get swept up in the moment, and they're all psyched. Well, 24, the garments in view were the more heavy cloaks worn as outer clothing, not the inner tunics worn next to the skin. And it was likely a warm spring day when people would have shed their outer garments by the afternoon and would have had them in hand. Matthew 5:40 just makes a distinction there between the outer garment and the inner garment, the inner garment being called the shirt. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. That would be the outer garment. And so again, assuming it's a warm spring afternoon by this time, and we are into the afternoon and possibly even into the late afternoon, what we're not told is how long all this takes. But we know the trip, you know, they've already made the trip over to Bethphage by the time he gets on the donkey. So the suggestion is he's only a half a mile or so maybe outside of Jerusalem, maybe even closer. But he's certainly within sight of the city when this all starts at Bethphage. And so how long this all takes, well, a half a mile, I mean, even if he's only moving at a mile an hour, this would have only taken 30 minutes, roughly. So when you see all this, you might think, well, this went on for hours and hours. No, it all happened relatively quickly. And as quickly as this flash mob came together, it dissipated, just like they do nowadays. I mean, it does not take this long to dissipate. This doesn't carry over for a long, long time, not even until that evening, in fact, because it appears that Jesus goes in and just sort of is assimilated into the populace and this all fades away, him and his apostles. Again, this just says it was a warm spring day. That's good. And it makes sense that they would have had their outer coats off by now. So 25, since there is no second verb in verse 8, it would mean that the people were cutting down vegetation and spreading it on the road, just as others had done with their cloaks. This is a fact that Matthew records explicitly, that they were actually putting these on the road as well. That's easy enough to figure out. If they're throwing down their coats before him and palm branches, or, well, actually it's more general, just vegetation. 21:8, most of the crowd spread their coats in the road, and others were cutting branches from the trees and spreading them in the road. There, the trees is generic. We're not really told, as it were, what sort. And 26, Mark is the least explicit about the type of vegetation being used. Matthew indicates it was branches from the trees. Well, what kind of trees? We're not told. While John makes it clear that these were the branches of palm trees. John 12:13. Uh, where he makes it very explicit. When the next day as they're coming into town, they heard Jesus was coming. They took the branches of the palm trees and went out to meet him and began to shout, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel." And of course, John records it in a bit of a flashback, Jesus finding a young donkey set on it. As it is written, "Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt." And the important point here, why do I think the crowds did not understand this? These things his disciples did not understand at the first. And if the guys closest to him didn't get it, it's unlikely that anybody else did. But when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written of him and that they had done these things to him. And so then they're able to put it back together with what the prophetic word had said. This is the way it's going to unfold. They go back and look at this event. Oh, now it makes sense. Now I see what was happening. But they had no capacity for it or understanding of it at the time. Okay, speaking of time, we're done. We'll stop there and continue on here Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.